What's up? What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of The Periodic Table. This is the weekly science news show that I do over here at my YouTube channel, where, well, we talk about the hottest science news stories of the week. And are we experts by any means? Most of the time? Most of the time, absolutely not. But that's okay, because this is one big virtual science classroom, as I like to call it. And we are all here to learn and gain a better understanding of science together. And I think that's part of the fun. I am, of course, your host, Brandon Hanna. You might know me formerly as a host over at AfterBuzz TV or the Popcorn Talk Network, or you might also know me from the Movie Trivia Schmodown. But what you might not know is that I'm also a mechanical engineer, and I love science, I love technology, I love engineering, I love uplifting stories, and that's what we got here today. But I am not alone. I am joined by two amazing guests here today. Let's start off to my immediate left, your right. You might know him as, he was the longest reigning Movie Trivia Schmodown Star Wars champion ever, and he will be back. I promise you that. He is a true star all around, and you might know him as Star Wars Explained over on YouTube. It is Alex Damon.
What's up? It's still weird and hurts a little bit to hear was the longest reigning. I mean, I guess I still am. No one's broken the record yet, but I miss that belt every day.
you will get it back. You will get it. And the pain is, I think, what will help motivate you to win again.
Uh-huh.
I think so. It hasn't motivated me yet. I've had a lot of pain in the Schmodown, but hey, you know, we each have our own motivating factors. But thank you so much for being on the show, Alex. I'm super excited to have you on for the first time. But you are not alone. She is the co-host of A Certain Point of View, Star Wars Explains manager, from what I read on the social medias.
It probably needs an update.
Manager, wife, same thing.
Co-host exactly. As well.
There you go. The better half of Star Wars Explained, to probably be more specific. But she is also a Twitch streamer of her own, and also she is the maverick in the Movie Trivia Schmodown. It is Molly Damon. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I don't remember the last time I was in a science class, but I slept through most of it, and I promise I will not do that today.
Oh, it's okay. That would be a first, though. That would be impressive to have somebody fall asleep on this show. But no, it's gonna be a fun. I promise you, you will not get bored. I hope. We normally like to have a lot of fun on this show. Keep it loose, keep it light. We got three amazing topics for you all today, starting with cities having their own distinct microbial fingerprints, which I think is particularly interesting. What can that lead to down the line with maybe even forensic science? We'll see. And we also have a really great story here of a sweet father-son bond that inspires tasty new molecule models, almost worthy of its own special segment, but it is not our special segment today. What we do have here is what I'm calling science at home, and we're going to show you, according to the New York Times, how to become an outdoor scientist in your own right this summer. But let's jump all the way back up to our number one story for the week. And we are talking about cities having their own distinct microbial fingerprints. And this is coming from Science Magazine. And guys, as always, the links to the articles are always in the description down below if you want to read them more for yourself. But let's get started here. When Chris Mason's daughter was a toddler, he watched intrigued as she touched surfaces on the New York City subway. Not something you'd want to do today, I don't think. Especially this next part, because one day she licked a pole and there was a clear microbial exchange, says Mason, a geneticist at Weill Cornell Medicine. And he said, I desperately wanted to know what had happened in more ways than one, I'm sure. But he started swabbing the subway, sampling the microbial world that coexists with people in our transit systems. And after his 2015 study revealed a wealth of previously unknown species in New York City, other researchers contacted him to contribute, and now Mason and dozens of collaborators have released their study of subways, buses, elevated trains, and trams in 60 cities worldwide, from Baltimore to Colombia to South Korea. They identified thousands of new viruses and bacteria and found that each city has a unique microbial fingerprint. And before I get any further into that, I want to pause right here. And Alex, I want to throw it over to you first. What are your overall impressions, thoughts of this article? Did you learn anything specifically for the first time by reading this story that maybe excited your own personal interest in science?
Well, let me say that the first thing I wrote down, the first thing I had to stop and just read again was just, I had to get myself in the headspace of this father who watched their daughter lick a pole in the subway. And it was just like, fascinating. didn't try to get her away. I'm sure he did. But yeah, I do think it's pretty interesting, this idea that there are viruses that you can only find, or bacteria that you can only find in these specific cities. And we'll get down deeper into it in the article, where they were like, we were able to guess with 85% accuracy or something that we know which city this is by looking at its microbiome. I was like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is like, it is really interesting how, and we'll get into it further down in this article, how they're able to identify different cities across the world just based on the microbial life that you kind of put in a little petri dish and examine under a microscope. You could be like, ah, that right there, that's Baltimore.
That's gross. We know that's Baltimore.
Yeah. You're like, oh, definitely Tallahassee. Definitely. Oh God. But no, it is really fascinating. And I can't even imagine from a parent's point of view what my reaction would be in the same situation, but I'm sure I'd be inspired by science as well. Molly, let's throw it over to you next. Did you have any different takeaways from this article other than Alex, and what were your overall impressions of reading this?
My first thought was, I was like, I wonder if this is why, or one of the reasons why you can get sick just by traveling and being in like a new space. Because like, just it makes sense, I guess, with the way that this information is presented. Because yeah, I've gotten sick just by going other places and not being around other sick people. So it's I thought that was really interesting, and I was like, that makes a lot of sense actually. And then towards the end of the article, he talks about like they might have been able to see the pandemic coming, you know, if they had been doing this longer, started looking into this earlier, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, you make a really great point, because, you know, our immune systems get used to the, you know, viruses and bacteria that were constantly around. So if you're a New Yorker constantly on the subway, and then maybe you go over to Los Angeles on a business trip, it's a completely different variety of bacteria and viruses that your immune system is not familiar with at all, and could definitely, you know, slip right past those white blood cells and cause you to get sick and be like, whoa, like your body's just confused. Yeah. I mean, that at least that's what happened in War of the Worlds. I don't know how it applies to real life, but no, that is a great point. That is a really, really, really interesting point that I didn't even think about that at all, like reading this article. So, but yeah, it is interesting how in the story they did these experiments where they, you know, had people try to they tried to identify different locations based on the different microbes, the microbial life, and looks like to me in this article that they were able to, with an 88% accuracy, determine which city each sample was from. And that 88%, that's pretty good. It's not quite 100%, but I'd say that is pretty good, especially when you're looking towards the future of potentially how this could affect forensic science. I don't know if either of you are fans of, you know, those true crime podcasts or any type of shows like that, but I see Molly, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, those are murder shows.
I'll whip out a blue light if I need to. The hotel.
do you see this having an application towards solving crimes in forensic science in the future?
I mean, yeah, with that high of an accuracy, that's actually shockingly high. Yeah, you could kind of figure out where something started and then figure out from there where it spread to, and you know, so on and so forth. So I think this is big for that kind of thing.
Or I guess like the idea that a murderer could come in from out of town and leave behind like that one bacteria that they're like, oh, we know this came from Philadelphia. We got him. And like, just go back and at least you narrow it down to a city.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, narrowing it down to a city sometimes, that might be all it takes. Maybe you have a name and a general location. I don't know. Maybe at least that narrows it down enough where it could make an impact. I don't know. I don't watch a lot of true crime stuff, so I'm not too familiar. But if Molly says the 88% accuracy is a lot, then I'm going with that. That's really great. So it'll be interesting to see the applications of this science out in the real world going forward. But, you know, they also talk about there's a variety of new viruses and bacteria kind of being discovered. And also, it's kind of funny how they collected these samples. They talked about how the scientists had to swab individual surfaces for 3 minutes, which they decided was long enough to get the DNA, but not so long that it got weird for the researchers and bystanders.
I think I disagree.
You disagree?
If I were standing there waiting for a train and someone was next to me swabbing the bench for 3 minutes, I'd be like, what's this dude doing?
So you don't agree with Mason where he says it's the perfect balance between DNA yield and social discomfort?
I mean, do what you need to do. If you need 3 minutes, do it for the research, but don't say like we nailed the balance, because I disagree.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I would have to wait and see if I was in the situation for myself. But do you think it's more awkward to be the scientist in that situation or the bystander?
I think the bystander. I think the scientist is like, look, I'm here to do my work. I don't care what people think of me. But 3 minutes is a long time.
I was gonna say it might be more awkward for the scientists, because like, I don't know, someone could be like, this guy doesn't look like a scientist, he's just some weirdo taking swabs from the subway. Well, although as the person standing next to them sees it happening, they could be like, what am I standing in, oh god, and just get off the train.
I need to swab your foot.
Yeah, that would be something. But you know, maybe if everyone just kind of showed up in their lab coats,
yeah,
like me, then maybe it's like, all right, that guy's in a lab coat, he's clearly a scientist.
That's a good social experiment, just see what you can get away with for 3 minutes or however. Like, I'm wearing a lab coat, like I'm allowed to do whatever I'm doing.
Just like walk around, like pretend to collect samples. That'd be a good social experiment for sure. Do you want to be our test subject for that one, Alex?
Sure. Yeah, just send me out. Tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm. All right, I got it. That'd be funny. But no, this is overall, I thought it was it was an interesting story. I liked obviously the applications for forensic science, but also just the, you know, is literally was just inspired by some guy watching his kid lick a post on the subway. Which is interesting. It's always funny how these scientific experiments that we talk about on this show, how they begin sometimes in the strangest places. And I also really enjoyed that they were able to make new discoveries of science, of viruses and bacteria, because that could potentially in the future lead to help, you know, pharmaceuticals and medicine. And like you kind of mentioned in the end of our article, how it could have potentially predicted a global pandemic, which I thought was really interesting. So yeah, overall, a great story. Alex, Molly, do either of you have any closing thoughts on anything that we haven't touched on regarding this article before we move on?
We got through all my notes.
Yeah, that was all that I had to talk about too. But it is really interesting to see where research like this will go maybe in the next 5 to 10 years.
That's the, like, I know that this is cool, but I don't know why. I don't know what they're gonna do with it.
Hey, sometimes that is some of the best scientific discoveries and inventions come from such thoughts, I feel like. So you're not, you know, you're thinking of just like a scientist. So you're on the same page.
I knew it.
But yeah. But yeah, just also, I think this article also wanted to state, like, yes, it is kind of scary to be like, hey, look at all the viruses and bacteria and microbial life we're discovering on park benches and subway systems. And but they kind of reiterated that it paints a picture of safety, actually. What they're discovering is not particularly harmful to you know, people who frequent these public transportation systems. Like what Molly said, you know, if you do travel to a different city, kind of be weary that, especially now, I think we're all kind of weary. We all got hand sanitizer in our pockets mm-hmm. at all times. But so I think we don't really have to worry about that too much. But, you know, just take a little bit of caution because you might catch a cold or something.
So my allergies go crazy every time I go to Los Angeles. I'm just going to blame it on the bacteria now. You and your weird bacteria out there.
Hey, you leave our bacteria alone,
sir. LA bacteria is so much worse than Atlanta bacteria. East Coast bacteria is where it's at.
Oh yeah, this could open up a big can of worms with like who has the better microbiome, which big metropolitan city is the cleanest or the dirtiest, you know. Lots to be discovered.
Yeah, lots to be discovered. We'll have to wait and see. And hopefully there is no I don't know how to phrase it. I'll be like, well, no turf wars between various cities regarding who has the better bacteria. I don't know. But I say let's move on. I do want to thank everybody watching live with us now, or even watching the show on replay. Thank you so much for being here. If you're watching live, feel free to contribute to the live chat. Let us know your thoughts on the stories we're talking about here today. And please, if you can, hit that like button, hit that subscribe button, and that little notification bell so you don't miss a thing. If you want to talk science over here with us every single week, I would really appreciate you joining, because our virtual classroom is getting a little bit bigger every week, and it's a lot of fun. And so, yeah, I'm like, do I have anything else left to plug? No, I do not. But I do see we do have a comment here in the live chat. And apologies if I pronounce your name incorrectly. Deirdre Russell says, it always surprises me that there are not more advanced forensics used in Star Wars, etc. Alex, Molly, do you guys have any thoughts on forensics in the Star Wars universe and how that could be applied?
Well, I feel like we're learning some stuff in the Bad Batch right now, is between the tracking methods that Hunter uses and Tech, whatever that device was that he was going to use to check out the chips in their heads. There's a lot to be discovered there. That, yeah, I agree. They haven't talked about it much in Star Wars, but
it does seem like they don't really use. Obi-Wan's version of forensic science is running down to the diner and his best friend that cooks there and is like, hey, do you know what this is?
Yeah.
Like that. That's the most advanced forensic science we've seen in Star Wars so far. Mm.
And he knew what it was because of the funny little cuts on the side. It's right. Very, very exact science. So.
So I think there were some forensics in the Clone Wars when Ahsoka goes through her when she's framed for the Jedi Temple bombing, but Obi-Wan just seems to prefer the classic method of your old cook buddy.
Yeah.
Hey, it gets results. I think what you're really saying, Alex, is the key to forensics in the Star Wars universe is at the end of the day knowing the difference between knowledge and wisdom.
Nice.
Yes. Thank you. I had to do that. I love Dexter. He's great. Makes a mean Wampa burger for sure. But let's move on to something that could be tasty, but also scientific. And it is a sweet father-son bond inspired by we're talking about some tasty new molecule models. And this is coming from Science News. So guys, 13-year-old Noah Shaw loves planets and has perfect pitch. Wow. I have one of those two things in common. He's a scientist like his father, Brian Shaw, and who is a biochemist at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
I think it's Waco.
Waco. There you go. The correction. Normally, I'm like, I pause and I wait for somebody to correct me when I just know I'm saying something wrong. So feel free to speak up. But Noah's path to science may not be as smooth as it was for his father. Diagnosed with retinoblastoma as an infant, Noah now has only one eye and permanent blind spots in his vision. People with one eye, like Noah, and people who have blindness or limited vision are actually very underrepresented in science, and they face barriers in STEM education. But in an effort to make science more inclusive, Shaw and his colleagues have come up with bite-sized molecule models that take advantage of the mouth's super-sensitive touch sensors, which can perceive finer details than our fingertips can, actually, which is something that I feel like this is maybe something that I knew, but I also felt like I was learning it for the first time reading this article. I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. It is interesting to kind of go down the route that they go in this article, because the team actually created gummy candy models of important proteins, including myoglobin, which provides oxygen to muscles. And they also 3D printed non-edible, non-toxic versions for people to put in their mouths, but also attaching a lanyard to the non-edible plastic versions to prevent choking, because I could see how there could be a potential mix-up there. And the team tested how well 281 college students and 31 grade schoolers could tell edible or non-edible models apart while blindfolded. And of course, the non-edible models were properly sanitized in between uses, which is encouraging to know. But before I go any further into exactly how this experiment was set up, Molly, I would like to throw it over to you first. What were your overall impressions on this article? And did anything particularly stand out to you that piqued your scientific mind, your curiosity, if you will?
Yeah. So first of all, I feel like this is what the little girl in the previous article was doing. She was way ahead of her time. But it was really interesting too. Like, I had no idea that being able to know what things are when they're in your mouth as opposed to having it in your hand. And I was like, that's crazy. And I immediately wanted to find something and put it in my mouth and see if it was true. I have not yet, but I plan to still.
I did, and I swallowed 8 Lego pieces.
Oh no. Not again.
I'm confused with your Lego candy again.
But and it does make a lot of sense when you think of it. We were just visiting one of my friends yesterday, and she has a new baby, and they put everything in their mouths, you know? So that's how you kind of learn what things are when you're very, very young. So that's shocking how kind of obvious but not obvious that would be. So yeah, this is really interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting how, you know, as adults and as scientists, people are now catching up to the idea of what kids instinctively do when they're young to learn about new objects and new things. Just like within their grasp, kids always trying to put stuff in their mouths that they're not supposed to, but it has been proven a little bit now that they might've been right. There is some scientific merit to doing such a thing, as long as you be sanitary and safe with it. Of course, Alex, I'd like to throw it over to you next. What were your overall impressions of this article? And do you need any help retrieving those Lego pieces?
Well, I'll let you know in a few days. I was just impressed with the idea that people were able to know what they were putting in their mouths as accurately as blindfolded people using their hands. Like, my immediate thought is like, how can that be? But trying to imagine, yeah, handling different stuff with your eyes closed, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I guess it might be easier to tell when your tongue is kind of like one big finger that can wrap around something. I mean, it kind of does make sense. Mm-hmm. That's what I took away. My tongue is a giant finger.
that's a solid, totally reasonable takeaway, I feel like. But you know, this was like an interesting experiment, like you just kind of just touched on, Alex. Each student examined one protein model, either by mouth or by hand, and for every additional protein model that the students assessed, they had to determine whether the protein was the same as the first or different. And a separate group of 84 college students did the test by eyesight using 3D computer images of the proteins instead of physical, like tangible models. And students correctly identify the proteins about 85% of the time, like you were saying, Alex, regardless of whether they use their mouths, fingers, or eyes. And it says here that such cheap, tiny models could help students learn about proteins regardless of vision acuity, which I think that's right on the money, like 85% of the time, regardless of how they were attempting to identify the models. So with using slightly different methods, a student who has good vision or a student who might be completely blind or have some vision impairment, they can learn the same information and they can learn it just as well, that same 85% number, either way. So it kind of like they're trying to do here is level out that playing field and make it more accessible for students with vision impairment to learn more about STEM and science and all that stuff. And I actually, before I forget, because sometimes I do forget on this show, I do have this picture here from the article itself. And the caption says, bite-sized replicas of real proteins, such as this gummy model. So the gummy model is on the left of a calcium binding protein. And the computer imaged model is on the right. And like we said, it could make science more accessible for students who are blind. So the left is the gummy one. So that looks like the edible model. And I'll say for something that is a gummy and is edible, there seems to be a lot of detail, a lot of fidelity in that model. It's actually, I think, really impressive. And also how much it matches the 3D model, I think is really, really interesting. But yeah, this is a really cool story, and it was inspired by Shaw eating blackberries, I believe, is what it says in the article. Twirling blackberries around with his tongue, he realized just how well he can feel the bumpy exterior of the blackberry. And that kind of gave him the idea of, I think, using your tongue to identify various objects. And there was also one other thing in this article about a student in Hong Kong made headlines in 2013 for teaching herself to read Braille using her lips. And says, yet the mouth's remarkable sensing ability remains largely untapped in science education today, but it looks like hopefully changes to that will be made in the future going forward. And just overall, that's a really positive article. Like I said up top, that is something I sometimes do a special segment on the show called Scientist Spotlight, and I think this article would have been perfect for something like that as well. But I did want to do a different special segment here today. But before I do, I just want to once again ask if we have any closing remarks on the story from either Alex or Molly before we get moving forward.
I just think it's interesting because you brought up the blackberry thing, and Molly already brought it up, but that both of these were were inspired by people putting things in their mouths.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is a great idea to make this sort of science more accessible to people with visual impairments, like you said. But also, I mean, you make candy part of science, and kids are going to be in for that. So
you're just going to make sure they identify it before they swallow it.
Sure.
that's what the lanyard's for. Yeah.
Don't back, girl.
But no, that was actually before I read the article, when I was just reading the headline and the picture involved and everything. I was like, is this just plastic pieces they're putting in their mouths? I'm like, oh no, they're gummies too. That's interesting. I'm like, I would do that.
Yeah.
I want to be a part of this experiment. That sounds fun. I'm on board. But But no, yeah, really, really great story, guys. But let's move on to our special segment for this week. And this is something that I am calling Science at Home. I think it's fun to kind of talk about, you know, we're approaching summertime and, you know, we're feeling a little safe going outside, but, with, you know, vaccinations and everything and the world slowly opening back up. But if you want to be outside, but also still be in the safety of your own home, why not do some science experiments? And that is exactly what this article from the New York Times is all about, and it is becoming an outdoor scientist. And the article says here, right up top, if you like looking at trees and bark and the pattern of veins and leaves, if you are fascinated by clouds or the spots on a ladybug's back, if you like to split open rocks and see what's inside, then you are already an outdoor scientist. The best part is you don't need any special or fancy equipment. You don't need to remember a charger. You just need your eyes and the power of observation. And this article kind of goes into a handful of different scientific experiments that you can perform in your own backyards, including making your own crystals, capturing a paw print, measuring a tree, making a constellation map, and making a pine cone bird feeder, which all sound a lot of fun. The constellation map might sound particularly interesting to me. I always find myself looking up at the stars whenever I'm outside at night, as much as I can in Los Angeles. There's a lot of light pollution over here, which is another check mark in the cons section right next to our bacteria. It's lesser than the Atlanta area. But
Atlanta's not much better.
But, you know, Alex, I want to throw it over to you first. What were your overall thoughts on reading this article? Did any of these experiments interest you to the point where you're like, maybe I'll try one of these this summer and see how I'll do?
Honestly, it hit me mostly with nostalgia because I know I did some of the, like, I made a pine cone feeder. I definitely did the crystal thing. The constellation map was the most fun sounding to me because I agree. I love seeing the stars, and whenever we're like out at a cabin or somewhere where there is no light pollution, I think it's the coolest thing. So that's, I guess, the second best, next best thing you can get in a city.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Molly, what about you? Did any of these experiments bring back nostalgic feelings from childhood, or did any of them make you say, hey, I want to do this today as an adult because science experiments are fun?
We did see an interesting looking bird in our backyard the other day, and I don't, like, maybe I'm turning into a bird enthusiast, but yeah, I would make the pine cone bird feeder just to see if we can get that cool looking bird back in our yard. But the whole article was really cool, and it just made me think that, like, over the past year and a half of the pandemic and, like, kids having to, you know, go to school from home, and you know, these are great ways for teachers to get kids more into science, even if they can't be at school, if they're at home. It's like, here's a bunch of really creative ways to learn about science at home. And it's kind of cool how the pandemic, like, brought some of this creativity out for teachers and students.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's always fun to see articles like this. Very oftentimes, when looking up scientific topics for this show on a weekly basis, I come across local news stations always having a story or like a video saying like, hey, kids, here's a science experiment that you can try at home. And I always think that's great to, you know, have like a fun activity that encourages, you know, scientific curiosity in, you know, kids and young adults of all ages, and because, you know, obviously science is really important, but and you know, I know when I was growing up, it wasn't actually always my favorite subject in school. It wasn't until high school for me when I took physics for the first time, because I was always a math geek. I'm like, whoa, what do you mean math and science at the same time? I'm like, okay, I'm like, you got my interest. And then as I got older, I grew a broader appreciation for all the different various fields of science. But I don't want that to happen to you know, all the kids out there. I want them to have that appreciation at a young age. You know, I didn't really get to do a lot of these fun outdoor experiments as a kid. But now as an adult, I've got a little bit of free time on my hands. I might have to explore some of these. There's a couple of trees outside I could try measuring, maybe. Definitely the constellation map.
The crystal thing is cool. I remember that.
Yeah, the crystal thing too. I'll have to look into that one as well. Capturing a paw print, though. How do you guys feel about that one?
That sounds like a mess.
that one involves plaster. I think we would make a giant mess if we tried that. But if you have worked with plaster before, then yeah.
I think we'd be fine until we went to put one of our pets' paws in, and then it would be chaos.
Yeah, probably.
You know, I think we have a residential skunk that lives outside. Like, maybe I can try to get his or her paw. You know, that might work. I don't know.
Yes, do that. Record it.
Yeah.
Update us next week.
That would be content. That would get views. That would be something. But really fun, interesting stuff here. So guys, if you want to try some experiments at home, perhaps if you have kids at home and you're looking for something fun to do this summer, I highly encourage at least trying a few of these. And of course, try to avoid anything that might be messy or dangerous or get you sprayed by a skunk inevitably. We wouldn't want that. But I can be a little bold.
Leave that to the people in lab coats.
Yeah, leave it to the people in lab coats for sure. But science isn't just for people in lab coats. Science is for everybody. And I hope you all enjoyed joining us for this show here today. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Molly, so much for being on the show, talking science with me. I hope you had fun. I hope you learned something new. And I hope you feel a little inspired to just, you know, put more things in your mouth out of curiosity, and maybe you can lead to a new scientific discovery in the future. In all seriousness, thank you so much. Let's go one at a time here. Alex, if the good people watching want to follow you in all your endeavors on the internet and beyond, where can they find you?
You can find both of us on Star Wars Explained, our YouTube channel, where we talk about Star Wars and all the new content that comes out. So covering a lot of Bad Batch recently, The High Republic, and you can follow us on Twitter at Star Wars Explained.
There you go. Great. And Molly, other than your ventures in the Star Wars universe, where can people find you online?
You can find me here at Molly Damon on Twitter. And also, if you're a fan of the Schmodown, you can check me out on A Certain Point of View. We break down and talk about all the matches and do play-alongs and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Awesome, guys. Please go support Alex and Molly. Go subscribe to Star Wars Explained right now if you haven't done so already. Like, seriously, the best Star Wars channel on YouTube. Definitely go check them out. I love all the content that they do. And I'm, of course, your host, Brandon Hanna. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at BrandonHanna07. If you're watching right now, you've already found me at my YouTube channel, youtube.com/BrandonHanna. Please, if you feel the kindness out of your heart to subscribe, I would really appreciate you joining us here every week to talk about science and other nonsense, and putting stuff in your mouth and trying to get skunks' paw prints, because this show is just silly sometimes. And of course, like a lot of people, I do have a Patreon, patreon.com/BrandonHanna. If you feel generous, if you want to look there to see which tier is right for you, as they say so many times in these types of plugs, I am doing a watch along sometime this month of 2010, The Year We Make Contact, which is the sequel to 2001, A Space Odyssey. I forget, somehow it came up in conversation during a stream last month with some of my patrons and friends. And well, I'm just gonna go with it. So I think Roy Schneider is in that movie. I don't know. We'll get into that then. But until next time, guys, as always, thank you so much for taking time.